Our ability to make music is one of the things that makes humans unique. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many of us enjoy making music alone and in groups. Today we'll explore the drive to perform and what making music does for us physically and mentally. And later this hour, sacred harp music. It's also called shape note singing. It's an American art form and a singing tradition that dates back to colonial times. Singers perform music in four-part harmony, and many groups sponsor day-long sings. We'd also love to hear from you. Why do you make music? What does the experience of making music with other people do for you? Give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On the pedestrian mall in downtown Iowa City, there are two pianos. The Ped Mall has always been a popular place for making music, but these public pianos have really brought out the performers in people. We sent Christina Sarnelli, one of our student producers, to the Ped Mall on a beautiful afternoon, and she found a couple of people singing and playing the guitar and a number of people lined up to tickle the ivories on the pianos.
What's your name and where are you from?
Sarah, and I'm from Mary.
And what do you think about them putting these pianos out in Iowa City?
I think it's a really fun idea. I'm surprised people are taking to it and not, like, vandalizing it and being crazy idiots with it, and I think it's really fun.
Do you play the piano regularly?
I don't. I used to take lessons in elementary school, but...
And what are you going to try and play right now?
This is something that my sister and I played together for piano lessons for a recital, and I was probably in about fifth grade.
That's good. What do you think of that?
I think that's really good. She's obviously a talented piano player.
So what's your name and where you're from?
I'm Spencer Watts, and I'm from Buena Vista, Colorado.
And what brought you out here to play the guitar today?
I'm going to have to say it's the beautiful people and the beautiful weather.
And what kind of music do you play?
All original. I write everything myself, but I'm highly influenced by bands like Red Hot Chili Peppers and Tool and things like that.
Okay, so what are you going to play for me now?
I'm going to play a song that I wrote, and it's called Get a Clue. And I wrote it for a girl that I fell in love with, but she's no longer here.
I thought I smelled your scent today, but God stepped down and swept that away. It's alright, it wasn't meant to be, and it may have meant a little more to me. And I thought I heard your sweet voice sing, but it faded off to a nullified ring. And never again can I feel your touch, cause to see your face was to ask too much. And I thought I saw a ghost walk by, her tears turned to dust as I watched her cry. And all I could do was sit and shed a tear with you. I don't think you had a clue. So what was I supposed to do? You disconnect from all that's true. You ask what's wrong with me, what's wrong?
Okay, what's your name and where are you from?
Megan Ree from Council Bluffs.
And what are you going to play?
The theme from Harry Potter.
What do you think about this project that Iowa City is doing with the free piano set around campus?
I am very excited about it because I'm walking to class and I sit down and I play on the piano and then I go back to class.
All right, thanks so much. Yeah. Well, do you want to tell me what your name is?
Megan Ree from Council Bluffs.
And Megan, what made you come out here and want to play today?
I needed a free piano to play on.
Okay, and what song are you going to play for me today?
Jazzin' Around.
Those pianos and the fact that people love to play them got us thinking about musical performance and what drives human beings to make music. One of the men responsible for those pianos is Steve West. He's chairman of West Music in Iowa City and also an underwriter on Iowa Public Radio. Steve, where did the idea to put pianos out on the pedestrian mall come from?
Well, actually, it started over a year ago. This was a program that originated in London, and Mark Ginsburg, a downtown business person, picked it up, and as well as I did in the news media, and we talked about it about a year ago. And then the same project came to New York City and some of the boroughs around New York, and Mark Moen also picked that up about at the beginning of the summer and said, hey, we've got to do this. And so Mark and I, or the two Marks and I, started collaborating along with my son Ryan at West Music and started to put together a plan of what we needed to do. We found the pianos, and then we had to get it all cleared up through city government to make sure that it was not a nuisance or abusive or whatever else. And in Mark time, I must admit, we got it through the city administration. We're very supportive of the idea. And so the two that are out there now are really samples or trial programs. And if these are successful, there is an interest possibly of expanding it to some additional pianos downtown.
What was it about the project in London and in New York that really appealed to you and made you think we should do this?
Well, I think Iowa City has always had a flair for creativity, of getting people outside. The downtown has been very open to with the pedestrian part of the downtown to make sure that it is accessible to all kinds, all groups. All talents, all kind of music genres. So this is a pretty natural step to what we need to do. And we like to think of ourselves as creative, open societies, and this is certainly an opportunity for all generations, all genres to express themselves through music in a very uninhibited way.
When the pianos first went out, did you kind of haunt the area to see how people would react?
Well, we have. First of all, when we decided to do it, we realized we needed to do some type of climatizing of the pianos. We also had special covers made for them so we can cover them up in inclement weather. The two Marks have been fabulous in making sure that they're maintained and keeping an eye out on so that they are covered up at night and that type of thing. So we really thought that it didn't take as much time as we thought, though we now are going forward, we're going to have to make sure that they're bolted down to the Ped Mall so someone doesn't tip them over. But so far, people have been very respectful for it because they realize that if they destroy or aren't respectful for it, other people aren't going to be able to express themselves. So it's actually worked out amazingly well, and I think we're very pleased with the respect that everyone's given them.
Have you been surprised by how many people are playing them?
Well, yes and no. The two previous programs in London and in New York have been an amazing success as well. I think what we find is that there are 20 or 30% of the population that does play music. And many times there are barriers. If you're a college student or you don't happen to have a piano where you're living or you don't have access at a church or whatever else, there are not very many opportunities for you to express yourself. As adults, many times we're too inhibited to kind of play in public, but this is kind of an easy way of just sitting down, doing it, enjoying it, and we're having some marvelous response, incredible musicians, and some that aren't as incredible, but they're still getting a great deal of enjoyment and pleasure from just playing and expressing themselves and their creativity.
Yeah, well, one of the pianos is very close to the playground on the Ped Mall, yes. And I have two small kids, so I spend a lot of time at the playground on the Ped Mall. And they're busy all the time. Yeah. There are people performing, and people bring piles of sheet music with them and clearly are sitting down and spending a lot of time performing on those pianos.
Well, they do, and there are some amazing talent. And, of course, you just talked about one of the important things for me is to have young children or all ages see all ages playing in all kinds of genre. I think in many cases we don't show ourselves just playing the piano, not just for performance, but for playing it for recreational, for enjoyment, for all kinds of reasons that music can bring to anyone that sits down and plays, no matter how good you are, being able to express yourselves is very therapeutic. And I think our other guests on the program, Mary, can really talk to the importance of that. But we're all wired to make music. It's just a matter of what barriers have been erected so that we can't have access to it, or, you know, we don't have time, we didn't take lessons when we were young, that we don't have an instrument, all those kinds of things. There are solutions to every one of those. And I think that's really one of my lifetime ambitions, is to break down those barriers and making sure that everyone has access, because it really is quite fulfilling.
Well, and as you mentioned with us today as well is Mary Adamek. She's the director of music therapy at the University of Iowa. So, Mary, why do you think someone would sit down at a public piano and play?
Well, I think there are many reasons why people make music. And sometimes people are just looking for some attention, and that might be one of the reasons downtown. But Steve talked a lot about self-expression, and the ability to express yourself through music is a very powerful – music can be a very powerful tool for that. People sometimes say, well, music is a universal language, and those of us in the business would say, well, it's really not a universal language, but it certainly is a universal phenomenon, and music is can be seen in every culture, and people use music in many, many different ways. So, you know, people make music because, like I said, they want to express themselves. They make music to be with other people. It's a very much music can bring people together. That's one of the main functions of music, is that we make music in groups so that we can solidify our culture, our identity. We use music in religious groups, and all of that brings people together.
I know that there has been research done on this, but what happens to you physically when you perform music?
Well, the brain is an interesting thing. There's actually a new, relatively new area of research called music neuroscience. And I don't happen to be one of those researchers. I'm a music therapist. The music neuroscience folks are looking at what areas of the brain are actually stimulated when people are making music, when they're listening to music. And there's all kinds of research out there about that. But just on an everyday level, when we make music or when we listen to music, we can have a physical response. So if you're hearing something and all of a sudden there's a marching band or some kind of music coming through, you start to move and you tap your foot, and it gets people moving. I mean, you put some lively music on and people start to move. So there's a physical response. There can be an emotional response. If you hear music that if I hear music that we sang at my father's funeral, I go right back to that spot. I get that emotional response just from that song. And it didn't happen before my father's funeral, but it happens now. So I make that connection. And then there's that social response of bringing people together and interacting with people through music.
And we will talk more about that in a moment. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guests today are Mary Adamek, Director of Music Therapy at the University of Iowa, and Steve West, Chairman of West Music in Iowa City. And we're talking about making music alone and making music together. And we'd love for you to join our conversation. Why do you make music? What drives you to perform? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about making music together, making music in groups, the power of making music, and the drive to perform. And we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. In about 15 minutes, we're going to be talking about sacred harp singing or shape note singing. And right now, with me is Mary Adamek. She's Director of Music Therapy at the University of Iowa, and also Steve West, Chairman of West Music in Iowa City, and also one of the people responsible for putting pianos out on the pedestrian mall in downtown Iowa City. Mary, you are a music therapist. How can you use music to help people heal, and heal from what?
Well, music therapists work with people with all sorts of abilities and disabilities, and all across the age span. So right here in Iowa City, we have music therapists working with premature infants and their parents, We work with children with autism. We work with adults and adolescents and children with developmental disabilities. We work in hospice. We work in medical care. So we work really across the age span and the ability and disability realm. Steve West over here to my right is a big supporter of music therapy, and he actually they actually have about 15 music therapists who work through West Music, and they do contract services in nursing homes, schools, and all kinds of facilities. So what a music therapist will do is look at what are those non-music goals that a person is working on. So maybe I'm working with someone with dementia who is very isolated. And because of their dementia and their anxiety and their inability to know where they are. And I can use music with them to help them decrease their anxiety and help them become latched onto something that's familiar to them, because I can use music from their very early adulthood that they may still remember. It might be one of the only things. And I've had I've been in sessions where a person who absolutely cannot carry on a conversation will hear a song that she remembers, like Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. She'll sit down, she'll look at me, she'll sing all the words. And that may not seem like a really big deal, but for the family member who is there with them, all of a sudden mom's back. And all of a sudden this person is no longer anxious for a few minutes. She's settled down and she's not burning extra calories because she's pacing out of her anxiety. So the music helps her feel less anxious and more grounded.
I had a chance to sit down with Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary not long ago, and he's working on an anti-bullying campaign, and he travels around to schools, and he sings with kids. And he was talking to me about the importance of giving kids the experience of singing with other children, and he said that's something that we just don't do as much as we used to do. Why do you think that's important to give people the opportunity, and particularly children, of performing music with a group?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that solidifies that social connection. And I can certainly see the connection to bullying. And if you're singing with someone, you're making music together, you're working on the same thing, you're cooperating, you are developing a product for which you're proud and that you want to share with other people, then you have to also establish relationships to do that. And you can establish those kinds of relationships through music.
Was there an experience in your life when you were growing up that you remember where the experience, the act of making music really was powerful for you?
Absolutely. I was a flutist growing up, and I loved playing my flute, and I would practice maybe 3-4 hours a day in college, and it was just a part of me. And I remember sometimes when I was in college once, when I was practicing in my apartment, and I was right next to a church, and I was on the first floor, and somebody from the church came over to my window and said, "Oh, I just love your music. Would you come and play at our church?" And the act of sharing that with other people was very powerful for me.
How about you, Steve? Do you have a memory growing up and performing music that really sticks with you?
Well, I have a lot of them. Obviously, growing up, my father and mother had started West Music in the early 40s, a little before I came along, and so I was always going to be involved in music. But fortunately, I really enjoyed it. So. There are so many. I don't know where to start, but certainly I continue to play music in the community band, and I live literally vicariously through each one of the experiences of our customers and the people in the community that are playing. I mean, music really is a very powerful tool for those of us that are. I don't know if any of us are normal, but for those that are more challenged, it even seems to be even more important. And that's what the side of music therapy is extremely rewarding. And actually, the program of making music, whether you're good or bad, I'm not a great musician. I don't practice nearly what I should, but that's okay because I really enjoy making it when I do, because it's something about the brain. You have to concentrate in doing it. There has been research that Mary has brought up that shows that the brain is more active when you're making music than virtually any other exercise in life. There are so many parts of the brain that are firing at the time that it really is quite therapeutic and for the individual. And obviously, if other people enjoy what you're playing, that's just a kind of a side benefit in some respect.
Wendy is on the line from Waterloo. Hello, Wendy.
Good morning.
Hi there. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I sing with a group of women called the Lovely Lemon Sisters from Waterloo. We've been singing together for, 10, 15 years. And we had an experience very similar to what your guest shared, singing in a nursing home a while back. We sing a lot of 1940s style Lennon sister music, McGuire sister music. And recently, singing in a nursing home, there was a woman who is nonverbal. She does make lots of noises, happy, joyful noises, but nonverbal. And when we started to sing, she started to sing in her own way. So one of the aides took her just outside the door, just down the hall, just so she wouldn't disrupt but could still enjoy the music. And she looked up at her and she goes, "But I know this song." And for us as friends, the music has, and being together as part of the group has really sustained our friendship over the years. But the joy that we receive when we go into a situation like that and see the residents reliving joyful memories from their lives and bringing just a little bit of happiness into their lonely days is very meaningful for us.
Wendy, thank you so much for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, you mentioned that performing music, even if you're not particularly gifted, can still be a powerful experience. And Mary, I'm sure you've experienced this too. There are many of us who are not particularly musically gifted, and singing or performing with a group or when anyone else can hear us can be a really anxious experience. How do you deal with that if you have someone that you're trying to work with who is anxious about performing?
Well, in music therapy, it's not all about performing. So sometimes people will be making music, but we don't push people to do that. And we can, they can receive the music. We can play music for them, music that's preferred, music that maybe is familiar, music that, depending on what we're working on, may help their anxiety. Frequently, people will say, "Well, I'm not going to go to music therapy. I can't sing." That's what we get all the time. But we have to reassure them that there are many other benefits that they can get from music therapy.
Well, Steve, how do you think people can get past that?
Well, I think we've come a long ways, actually, in the last 20 years. You know, it used to be that the window of opportunity getting involved in music was in elementary school, junior high, and high school. And if you didn't get involved, then you weren't going to be a musician. And many of the people that did get involved got busy in life and got going in other things and didn't have the time or didn't have the right place. I think as a society, particularly here in Iowa, we've really opened up the opportunity for many people to get involved at any age. And it's not about getting – you're not doing it for somebody else's pleasure. If you look at it from that, you're doing it for your own benefit. And certainly we all can benefit from other people's making music. But the anxiety or being inhibited about doing it as adults – I think we're coming a long ways on that, but we need to kind of check that at the door. Why are we doing it? It's not to impress anyone. It's doing it to show that we have what we've worked towards, to show to ourselves that we can do it. And then internally, we really feel much better after we do it. And that's really why I do it. And I think that's why most people play, whether they're playing professionally on stage or just for their own enjoyment and gratification.
So we started with the pianos on the pedestrian mall, and you talked about protecting them from the weather, the inclement weather, all summer long. When do the pianos go away for the winter?
Well, they're going to go away probably at the end of October, and we're going to look at the possibility of us reenacting it and maybe even expanding it next spring, again, if the City Fathers give us the go-ahead.
All right. Thank you so much. Steve West, chairman of West Music in Iowa City, and also Mary Adamick, director of music therapy at the University of Iowa. Thank you for your time today. We're talking about music on Talk of Iowa, and coming up in the next part of the program, we're going to talk about sacred harp singing. This is Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about making music, why we perform, and what it does for us physically, mentally, and even spiritually. Sacred harp singers perform music together. It's an American art form that dates back to colonial times and is practiced today by groups around the country. One of those groups is Prairie Harmony in Southeast Iowa, and Jennifer Hamilton is with the group. She's with us today. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi.
And also Eric Saylor is an associate professor of musicology at Drake University. He teaches a seminar on shape note singing. Hello, Eric.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. And I want to talk about this art form and where it came from and how it works, but I think the best way to do that is to start with an example of music. And this is called Bear Creek.
Yeah, Bear Creek.
Here, just we're gonna play a little bit of it, and then we'll talk about it in a moment.
Oh, great.
'Listening to Bear Creek, and we were just listening to the first part of it, so I want to talk about what we are hearing at the beginning, because obviously we weren't hearing words coming through there. But Eric, why don't you start? Because the first thing we heard was a number.
Right. The number that you heard is the page number that's in the Sacred Harp itself. The Sacred Harp is actually a hymn book. It's the name of it. It was first written or put together in 1844 and has been reprinted many, many times since then. When they call out the number, that means that everyone turns to page 269, and that's the tune that they'll go ahead and sing. Then you'll hear someone call out the pitches. They'll go ahead and sing the various solfege syllables that go with the notes that are being sung, and then everybody will go ahead and sing those solfege syllables.
And what are those syllables?
Well, what that means is when you look at a scale of music, you can go ahead and assign syllables to the various pitches. Most people will know it from, say, Sound of Music, Do, A Deer, A Female Deer, Re, A Drop of Golden Sun, and so on. But in shape note singing, there's only four different syllables that you use, fa, sol, la, and mi. The reasons for this are kind of complicated. It actually goes back to old medieval theory. But the larger point is it makes it simpler to go ahead and sing because you only have four different syllables to use. And each of those syllables gets a different shape assigned to it. So when you look on the page, the note heads aren't all round. They have different shapes. So if you see a triangle-shaped note head, you sing fa. If you see a circle one, you sing sol. If you see a rectangle, you sing la. And if you see a diamond shape, you sing mi. What this means is that if you get this basic theory down for how you sing these things, then you can look at just about any tune and sing it on the fly. Makes it really, really easy. In fact, this is how it was originally developed, was as a teaching tool to try to make learning music faster and easier for people who otherwise didn't have any contact with it.
So there are four syllables that are used. Does that mean that there are only four notes involved?
No. It's all, you can have as many notes as you want, but the shapes will go ahead and repeat. So if you sang a major scale, you would sing fa, sol, la, mi, fa, and you can go up and down as many octaves as you like to go ahead and cover all those. So you have all the notes available to you that you normally would.
Where does this music come from?
The earliest origins come from, some people say that there's an antecedent in late 17th century England. It really started to gain power in the United States, though, in the early 18th century. It started out as a means of originally reform, as I was suggesting before, for church singing. Because in colonial days, church singing used to be done in a form that was called lining out. And it was a really chaotic and really kind of unpleasant way for people to go ahead and sing. You would have a whole congregation singing essentially one tune all at the same time with the preacher up at the front going ahead and very quickly intoning the words that were supposed to be sung. So there's no director, there's no sense of rhythmic order or meter or other organization or anything like that, and it can be really, really sloppy. There were certain singers who didn't really like this and thought there should be some kind of more sophisticated, more kind of well-coordinated way of singing. After all, this was music that was being raised in praise of God, so you should go ahead and have something that sounds, you know, worthy of that. So there were new techniques of hymnody that came about being written that were trying to reform that. And in order to try to make this a little bit easier to sing in later generations, the method of writing notes that using note heads that had these different shapes developed. That was around the very beginning of the 19th century. But the sound of this music, you could hear it all throughout the colonies from about the early to mid 18th century on.
Jennifer, when you sit down to sing one of these pieces of music, okay, we heard the call, a little twitter there as people were turning to the right page, and then the singing of these syllables. What happens next?
So then there are four parts. So there's the tenor line is actually carries the melody. So that's oftentimes sung by men, which is unusual, and then it can be doubled. So there can be women that will sing that tenor line in the shapes, and then there's an alto group, sopranos, or treble, as it's referred to, in shape note. And again, that can be doubled too, down. So that could you could have men singing that line an octave down, and then the basses. So then depending on the song, whether they know it or not, we'll run through each line, and usually we start with the tenor line because that's the melody. And everybody will sing. Because, again, the purpose of this is to support all the singers in singing the songs together. This isn't so much a performance art as a community art, a participatory community art. So we sing for and to each other all the time. So we're actually facing each other. So they'll sing that tenor line. And then if anybody else needs help with their line, then you'll sing each of those lines. And then we put it together. So then you'll sing it in the shapes usually first to make sure everybody has their part. If you looked at a shape note book, oftentimes the words are in different places on the score. So if you know your line, then you're freer to read those words because they may not be right under your line. So we go through the shapes and then we start singing the words to it.
And it's all in one fluid motion. You sing all the shapes
generally,
and then you sing all the
go
words
right
together.
Into the words. And you'll have someone who will lead. And usually it's the person that requested the song. So they'll stand up and they'll mark the meter with a sort of a traditional hand gesture, whether it's 4-4 time or 3-4 time or whatever. There's certain hand motions that go with helping people keep the rhythm. So they'll lead it and then you sing through it. They sit down, someone else stands up, and we go on to the next one.
And you said you sing to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Lay out the room for me. Where
so
are you sitting?
We sit in a square. So you'll have the tenors generally face the altos, so they're faced across from each other. And then the trebles and the basses are facing each other. The person leading typically faces the tenors or the melody line. So that's how it's set up in a room. Obviously, it's not always that exact, but generally you're actually singing towards each other. And the beauty of that is that you can really hear these amazing harmonies that are created in this particular, that are kind of almost peculiar to this shape note tradition.
Well, let's listen to another example of a song sung from the Sacred Harp. This is Loving Jesus.
Dear heart, my loving Jesus, dear heart, my loving Jesus, dear heart.
That's a little bit of Loving Jesus, and we can hear the harmonies there. We did start that part of the way through, so all of the singing of those syllables had already been done, and this was the part where the lyrics actually began. Jennifer, what does it feel like to sit with a group of people and sing music like this?
It's as certainly was my experience when I started it, and a lot of people that I've talked to that have started singing this way, it really grows on you. Because at first it can sound, especially like I am, I'm used to singing in choruses, choral singing, where your orientation is towards the director, towards an audience, different tradition, different music and all that. And the joy of that, which is a really great thing, when you actually bend it in and you're actually being sung at from all directions, and in this particular harmonic style, it does something to you that's like magic. It's a very physical thing. It's very joyous and immediate.
There's the words are oftentimes some of the lyrics in these songs are very old and very beautiful, so it can be elevating in every way. Musically, it's elevating. The effect of the harmonies, and then the words or the lyrics to the songs are very beautiful.
Eric, do you also sing?
I do. I started singing Sacred Harp about 5 years ago. Was the first time I went to an actual sing. And she's absolutely right. I mean, the experience of being in the Hollow Square and being sung out from all four directions is amazing. But the experience of being there in a context where you're often not among professional singers, you're mm-hmm. there with people who just do it for any number of different reasons. For some people, they find a real religious or spiritual kind of elevation from it. Other people find historical interest in continuing an old American tradition. Others just really, really like the sound. Other people used to sing and just want the opportunity to do it in a context where, you know, they're not going to be judged or laughed at by anyone because it's very much a, you know, y'all come kind of context. You can come and sit down and sing and it doesn't matter, you know, what you sound like, what kind of experience you have. You are going to be welcomed and you will have a good time.
And these groups sponsor all-day sings. What is an all-day sing like, Eric?
It's astonishing. Iowa has started to have some all-day sings in the last several years. You can find more information on some of the ones that go on here in the state at sacredharpiowa.org, or if you're looking for them around the nation at fasola.org. But the very first sing I ever went to is one of the biggest ones in the nation that goes on. It's the United Sacred Harp Convention. And that the year I went, it was in Nashville, Tennessee. And the sound of going to a big, low room, you know, plaster walls, wood floor with about 300 people bellowing at the top of their lungs. I mean, it will part your hair. It's just the most astonishing sound and energy like you can't even imagine. And they start at about 9:30, 10 in the morning. They'll go till about noon, usually with a break for a drink somewhere in the middle. Have dinner on the grounds for about an hour, which is a sumptuous spread that you don't know where all this food comes from. It's just immense amounts of food to go ahead and fuel you for the rest of the afternoon. You'll come back at about 1 o'clock, sing till about 3:30 or 4, and that's your all day sing.
Jennifer, how does that feel when you get done with something like that?
You're just pretty high, you know. It's just you're just higher than a kite. I mean, we oftentimes after we're done, we'll be driving back because there are a group of us that go to these, and we'll sing on the way home of new songs that we learned or, you know, just, you know, reflecting on the day and that. But it's a real high. It's really wonderful.
Now, of course, as you mentioned earlier, Eric, this music is religious music. That was the whole purpose of it in the beginning, was to allow congregations to sing mm-hmm. together. Jennifer, is this a religious group that sings together?
Our group actually is wonderfully diverse. We have three ministers in our group. One is a Primitive Baptist minister. We have a United Church of Christ minister and a Methodist minister. We also have a Wiccan. We have an atheist. We have a couple of Quakers. We have a Roman Catholic. We have some just folklorists. So it's like he was saying, it really does draw in people for all kinds of reasons. And again, it comes back to, I think elementally, is the effect of the music that it has on you in terms of those harmonies and singing in that harmonic form. Because a lot of the chording that is in this music that's distinctive is that they're referred to as open chords, open fourths, open fifths, open octaves. And when you sing those, which is unique really to a cappella singing, when you sing in that way, it really does something to the physiology that creates a lot of joy, a lot of bliss. And so when we sing together, it just starts to flow regardless of where someone's coming from in terms of why they're there. Very respectful.
If you have sung Sacred Harp or if you have questions about shape note singing, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to play another example, and this is from your group, Jennifer, from Prairie Harmony. This is called Millbrook.
Oh, God, faithful God.
excerpt from Millbrook, sung by Prairie Harmony in southeast Iowa. And Jennifer Hamilton is with that group. She's here with us today. Eric Saylor is an associate professor of musicology at Drake University. He teaches a seminar on shape note singing. And that's what we're talking about right now, shape note singing or sacred harp singing. Jennifer, listening to that, that contrasts with the samples that we heard mm-hmm. earlier, which sounded more like almost a barn dance kind of, you know, a folk group together. Weird. Now that was really polished.
thank you. you know, this is a wonderful thing about this this form is that it lends itself to all kinds of interpretation. So you can get together and just belt, just sing and have a wee old time and just enjoy for that. And it definitely is powerful and wonderful. And it also lends itself, because of the beauty of the harmonies, the beauty of the lyrics, lends itself to taking backing down a little bit and then just, you know, polishing it and really singing it either more slowly or paying more attention to intonation, things like that. There are other groups like Anonymous Four and Boston Camarada who have also kind of discovered, in a sense, this tradition and have created CDs because of the beauty of the music. So it's great how it lends itself to all these different kinds of interpretations.
Eric, how did this music survive?
Well, it survived by moving away from where it was actually created, because it was relatively popular in New England through about the very beginning of the 19th century. But about that point in time, there came a shift in general tastes about what constituted good music. In fact, there was a whole movement that was called the Better Music Movement that was headed by people like Lowell Mason, for instance, who looked at the music of this sort that was being performed and thought that it was just appalling, because it was, as Jennifer was pointing out earlier, you know, it has all these open fifths and parallel fifths. That means you hear these intervals of fifths in rapid succession, which is completely against all the established rules of standard harmonic practice and composition, at least by European standards. And Mason, among other people, wanted to go ahead and try to raise America's profile in music. He thought the best way to do that was to show that Americans were capable of playing with the Europeans on their own ground, that they could write music that was just as good by those same rules and standards that the Europeans had. So in consequence, they started to kind of talk down, criticize a lot of this Yankee tune smithery that was around by that point. So the itinerant teachers who taught it and the composers who made it gradually moved out of the New England cities and south and west. So eventually this music wound up in Appalachia and in the Deep South particularly. Today it's in the Deep South, particularly in Alabama and Georgia, where the most vital shape note singing communities still exist. In fact, if you go to just about anywhere in the nation, people will either talk about going down south to get a real sense of how the tradition lives, or will be inviting southern singers to come up north so that they can see how it's done.
Jennifer, where did you discover it?
Well, interestingly, and when my children were young, we used to go to singing and dancing camps with them in the Northeast, out in Massachusetts. And one day they had a presentation, a very brief presentation of four people singing a shape note song, and my hair stood on end, and it was like, I want to do that. So I bought some books, and we brought the books home. I rounded up some friends, and we said, let's give this a try. So we kind of learned it actually in a way on our own. So I think that's why we might sound a little different, because we really learned it almost in isolation. We just took the books, got a few CDs, and that's how we did it.
How about you, Eric? When did you first become aware of this?
I actually came in contact with it when I was in graduate school. I heard some of Alan Lomax's old recordings of this. The Loving Jesus that you played earlier was actually part of Lomax's Southern Journey album series, and he recorded this at the United Sacred Harp Convention in 1959. And I heard this, and again, just like Jennifer said, it was like nothing else I'd ever heard before, and really like nothing since. And it was always kind of in the back of my mind. And then in 2005, I had a student who submitted a paper to a conference, and I went with her to it. And it just happened that the conference was being held in conjunction with the Sacred Harp Convention. So I thought, well, I teach this in world music class and so on. I should, maybe actually hear it done. And I did, and I was just hooked.
Is there new music being written for shape note singing, Jennifer?
Yeah, actually, that song Millbrook is a modern composition by a professor of music, Neely Bruce, who lives in North Carolina, who very generously let us record that on our CD. But there are a number of people that are continuing this tradition, and sometimes they really tweak it. They'll take it kind of to the limits of what we would consider kind of a shape note sound, and some people accept that, some people don't. But, yes, it is very much a living, dynamic tradition.
And very much and an American art form.
American art form, very distinctively American.
Eric?
It's kind of fun to see when some of these new tunes are tried out, too, because at certain conventions, people will come and say, hey, I brought this new tune. Let's go ahead and try it out. And you can really tell when the singers either absolutely go for it or very politely say, you know, this isn't our cup.
Right. Well, Eric Saylor is an associate professor of musicology at Drake University. Thank you so much for your time today, Eric. Thank
you.
And Jennifer Hamilton is with the group Prairie Harmony, shape note singers in Southeast Iowa. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going out today with a little bit of Ijumea. This is from the Cold Mountain soundtrack, Shape Note Singing. And Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Catherine Perkins. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and technical support from John Pemble in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.